Welcome to the Strang Report with Steve Strang on the Charisma Podcast Network. This episode was produced to discuss and address issues within our nation and around the world from a Christian worldview.
Hello, everyone. This is Steve Strang, and welcome to the Strang Report on the Charisma Podcast Network. Today, my guest is Mark Joseph. He is an expert about rock music, and he's just written a book called Rock Gets Religion. So that's a very interesting title, Mark. Can you get us started by just telling me why you wrote this book?
Sure. Good to be with you, Steve, and your audience. This is the third in a series of books that I began writing in 1999. And the first was called The Rock and Roll Rebellion, and it's not the rebellion you might think of. It's more about I was starting to spot a trend of artists that I were working with, young Christian artists, really rebelling against the idea that they had to be off in the corner of the culture in the Christian music section. And I don't mean by that that they were ashamed of their faith, but rather that they were really getting tired of having their music and their ideas sectioned off to only be heard by fellow Christians. And the second book was called Faith, God, and Rock and Roll in 2003, and then this is the final called Rock Gets Religion. The subtitle is The Battle for the Soul of the Devil's Music. And obviously having a little bit of fun with the idea that we had back in the 50s, starting then, that rock and roll was the devil's music. So really what the book is about is really the return of strong Christians and some not so strong Christians, but the whole return of young artists who are believers into the mainstream music industry and how they are, in many cases, coming with the same lyrics, but really doing it in the middle of the culture instead of off in a section of Christian music, which non-believers really don't access very often. And I think the wider issue, Steve, is this is what we do sometimes. Sometimes Christians, when we don't like what's happening in the mainstream world, we can break off and form our own sort of subdivisions. The problem there is that these artists lose contact with the non-believing world, and we end up having a very, very secular music culture, film, TV, whatever it might be, that many believers aren't present in. So that's a big picture of what the book is about.
Well, that's interesting. Tell me about the reaction you got to your first two books. And also in this book, you said that something seemed to accelerate around 2003. Tell me what that is.
Sure. You know, in the first book, I used the analogy of the Negro baseball leagues. And as I was researching for the book, it just sort of occurred to me that the story that I was trying to tell had something in common with the Negro baseball leagues. And what I meant by that was, as I researched the Negro baseball leagues, I realized it wasn't just sort of racist white people who wanted to keep black players out of the major leagues. It was also the Negro baseball league owners, because they kind of had a good gig going. And they didn't want Jackie Robinson to cross over because they knew it would be the end of their league, basically. And so you have kind of interesting forces that would work together to keep that from happening. And so I just found something similar. I found that the Christian music labels were actively keeping their artists from crossing over. I'll give you an example. There was a band named Jars of Clay, and the band would call Walmart and say, could you please put our CDs in the alphabetical section with J, with all the other artists? Well, their Christian music label was calling Walmart and saying, please put Jars of Clay in the gospel section. And so you literally had the artist and the label at cross purposes with each other. One trying to narrow market the band, and the band trying to be reaching all people. And so that's the real conundrum.
How was that resolved, Mark?
I think the label got their way. I think the label is more powerful. And again, you know, you have to put yourself in the mindset of a 17-year-old kid with a nose ring. He just doesn't go to the gospel section back then. Of course, it isn't thriving these days. But I would hear anecdotal stories. Friends of mine were in a group called POD. And the potential fans would hear about POD at a rock concert of Ozzy Osbourne or whatever, and they would go to the record store, and they would ask for POD, and they'd be told, well, they're in the gospel section. Well, that 17-year-old kid with a nose ring is not in the habit of going to the Gaither section and a gospel section in a store. So we really had a situation where it was becoming a turnoff to people who might be interested. But what you're referring to about the early 2000s, so there are basically four trends that happened. The first was, we were getting different theology. And what I mean by that is, In the 60s, 70s, and 80s, when a rock star or pop star would convert to Christianity, what would typically happen is his pastor would say something like, "Come ye apart from the world and be separate," and he would encourage that rock star to sort of cut his hair short and tour the country singing hymns. The problem with that was that person had millions of fans who weren't used to hymns and short hair and this new culture that he had embraced, and so he would lose a lot of his old fans and kind of embrace the church circuit. Well, Alice Cooper is the best example of this. So Alice Cooper comes back to his faith, becomes a born-again Christian. He goes to his pastor, and his pastor, instead of saying, "Come ye apart and be separate," he says, "Alice, does God make mistakes?" And Alice says, "Well, I don't think so." Well, he says, "Well, God made you Alice Cooper. So go back out there and be a transformed Alice Cooper with different lyrics, different lifestyle, and the way you handle yourself. But don't do things that will lose your fans who love you." So that's one thing that happened that was different. And Alice Cooper is the best example of the change. The second is young artists who are Christians, as I said earlier, decided, "Hey, I want to speak to the world. So I'm not going to go to Nashville. I'm going to sign to a mainstream label and do my best to try to allow my lyrics to still reflect my faith." The third strain is Christian artists who were in the Christian industry have crossed over into the mainstream side. And you hear about crossover a lot. That would be like Switchfoot or Joy Williams, different artists that have gotten into the mainstream and for the most part have kept their faith. And perhaps the most significant one is American Idol and the talent shows like that really transformed the ball game. So the stars that you and I grew up listening to in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, those were primarily selected for us. We didn't just discover the Eagles. Those bands were selected for us by, you know, 5 to 10 white guys in Hollywood who tended to be fairly liberal in their outlook and not very religious. And so really, we were discovering stars picked by them, and they became our rock and pop stars. They weren't picking the born-again Christian guy next door. And I actually have in the book an example that Keith Green, who became a great Christian singer, was first auditioned for and rejected by one of these guys, Clive Davis. So because Clive Davis tells him no, Keith Green has to go into CCM and becomes a CCM star. Had Clive Davis said yes, he would have had Keith Green, the mainstream star who is spreading the gospel in the mainstream. But what happens with American Idol and shows like that is suddenly those 10 people in Hollywood are irrelevant because the American people, through voting, are actually picking our pop and rock stars. And so that caused a lot of believers to become rock stars, pop stars in the 2000s. Carrie Underwood is an example of that. Daughtry is an example of that. Chris Allen. All these people who, in my estimation, would likely have been blocked by more secular record executives now become stars, and they can't really change that or stop that.
Mark, this is very interesting. We're going to pause now for a word from our sponsor. And then after the break, I want to ask you more about Alice Cooper. That sounded very interesting.
Start off 2018 with a fresh awakening to the promises of God. In the new Spirit-Filled Life Bible, Pastor Jack Hayford offers dynamic kingdom equipping through the power of the Word and the work of the Holy Spirit. For a limited time, pick up your copy 40% off at thomasnelson.com.
Welcome back. We're talking to Mark Joseph, the author of Rock Gets Religion, subtitled The Battle for the Soul of the Devil's Music. Quite a title. And the foreword is from Alice Cooper. And earlier in the segment, you said that Alice Cooper had become a born-again Christian. So just tell us a little bit about that odyssey, and how did you get someone as famous as Alice Cooper to write the foreword for your book?
Well, Alice's father was a missionary in Arizona, I believe to the Apache Indians, if I'm correct on that. And so he was definitely raised as a kind of a pastor's son. And he got away from it, and, you know, he really became a heavy drinker for a good part of his career. But it's funny because his father wrote the foreword to Alice's book in 1976. And like all dads whose children have wandered away, he wrote something like, "Am I delusional to think that someday God is going to bring my son back to himself?" You know, that kind of a thing. And so sometime in the 1980s, Alice does come back. His wife is an instrumental part of his coming back and being able to walk away from alcohol in a very miraculous way. You know, most people need to go to the 12-step program and this and that. Alice literally is one of those few cases of people who just walk away from it and substituted his alcohol with golf. So he's a golf fanatic that took the place of his alcohol. But, you know, what I noticed myself, what was happening, I think it was in late 80s, and I was watching MTV one day, and I saw this Alice Cooper song called Hey Stupid. And it was funny because in the middle of the song, there was a young couple that seemed like they were about to have sex, and this character in the middle of Alice's song walks in on them and says, Hey Stupid, as in sort of knock it off. And I said, well, this is kind of strange, Alice Cooper and MTV sort of making a case for morality. And that's when I began to dig deep and find out what had happened to him. And so we become friends. His wife is an amazing woman. You know, they were mentored long distance by R.C. Sproul, who has been a real influence in their lives. And then, of course, the pastor that I mentioned, who really helped him come to terms with being a rock star. And the contrast, Steve, is really to bands like U2 and Elvis, who the pastoring they received was more along the lines of, you really need to choose between this music and God, not really understanding that God had called them to that music and finding how can you incorporate the things you believe into this music. And that's the key change.
You know, a lot of people don't know, and you probably don't know, that my youngest son, Chandler, is in the music business. In fact, he's got a band called Saskatchewan, and I'm very proud of him. But he has a real call on his life. He has ever since he was a child. But he felt that he should go in secular music. Now, the type of music is bubblegum pop or something like that. It's just a really pretty style of music. But yet he's had some success moving in secular circles. So I find this very, very interesting what you're having to say. Tell me what you're hoping to accomplish with this book.
Sure. Well, I think for the mainstream or secular world, this is an interesting wake-up call. I don't think they quite realize what has happened in the last 10, 15, 20 years. And so I think it's an interesting sort of from a sociological perspective to see what's happened. I suppose I'm a fan of letting our art reflect who we really are. And the culture that I grew up in, this hyper-secularized society that I grew up in, is really not reflective of how we live our lives. You know, if a Martian dropped in from outer space and watched our movies, music, and television, they would think we are highly, highly secular people, and we're just not. I even go back to relatively innocuous shows like I Love Lucy. Go back and watch that show sometime and report back to me of when you see Lucy or Ricky ever attending church or mass, ever interacting with a priest, having any kind of religious life. It just doesn't exist in that show. But, you know, if you think about it, you've got a Cuban in Ricky, Ricardo, marrying an Irish woman in Lucille McGillicuddy. Call me crazy, but I'm thinking they're two Catholics. And yet, there's no religious life in that show whatsoever. So, basically, we've had 50, 60 years of pretend media that pretends that we're highly secular beings. And why we do it? You know, there's a variety of reasons. I think some people just don't like religion and want to pretend it doesn't exist in our lives. I'm sure there are corporate reasons. Maybe the I Love Lucy show sponsors said, listen, we don't want to be divisive, so don't ever show them going to church. I don't know what the reasons are, but I think we should always be truthful in our media, and we shouldn't pretend that we're a secular people when we're not. And for myself, you know, nothing inspires me more than a deeply spiritual song that is about the transcendent and is about God and spirituality and life after death and all those great things. So I'm a fan, you know, obviously rock gets religion. I also edited a book called Pop Goes Religion. I'm a fan of letting our spirituality inform our music. And also, in the 60s, there was this sort of feeling like, okay, well, we can have spirituality, but only if it's an esoteric spirituality from another country. It's like, yeah, we can have Tibetan Buddhism, and we can have the Maharishi, but we can't have Christianity because that's our grandmother's religion. And that's also weird, because it's just not how the way people live their lives.
You know, it's interesting, your insight about the secularization of our culture, which we're all familiar with. But I read a very interesting op-ed piece this week in which it said that just getting religion out of the public square, as the secularists seem to want, doesn't make America less religious. And he made a very interesting comparison. He said that when you take the extreme left, you know, the yell and scream and all this kind of stuff, they're no different in behavior than the worst example of a fundamentalist Baptist, let's say, although I don't want to malign those people, but, you know, just the real stereotype of someone who's a Bible thumper and going against what they consider to be heresy, because the left has this type of heresy too. So I just thought it was kind of interesting to hear your comment.
Well, I think you're touching on something really fascinating, which is when we take away religion, we still have the same religious impulses. I think it was C.S. Lewis who said, you know, when you take away the monarchy, you end up with the same functional monarchy, only it's pop stars, right? So we don't have a king and a queen in America. We just have Michael Jackson and Prince and Elvis. And so there is something, and maybe that's a desire that we humans have to kind of quasi-worship or adore some people. And I think the same is true with religion. It's funny that people railed against the fundamentalists who wanted to censor bad words. But now there's a whole generation of words that are taboo in the secular culture as well. I can't go through them because I'd be in trouble. So I think there's something there. We have a religious impulse. You know, we have a desire for the divine. We have a desire to worship or to give respect to some kind of a divine figure. And you can strip that away, but it's just going to be replaced by something else. And there are secular sacraments that are just as sacramental as communion or different Christian sacraments. And so I do think you're onto something there. And my answer is, let's get rid of this religious phobia that we have. And again, sometimes we may like the expressions of faith. And by the way, we have to be as consistent in supporting expressions of faith by other people that are not in our faith. But really, the more that religion is practiced freely and that it doesn't impose on somebody else, I think I want to err on the side of giving people maximum freedom to express themselves and their faith until it begins to infringe on, you know, in practical ways on everybody's lives.
Well, we could talk about this for a long time, and the podcast has already gone a little bit longer, but I have one more question, and we'll close with this. You told an interesting story about Mercy Me, and I can only imagine, in your book. Could you elaborate on that?
Sure. Part of Christians getting past the subculture mentality is it's amazing what happens when you return to the culture and participate in the way that things work. So, for instance, it's easy to say MTV is evil. Well, MTV is whatever people that work there are. So if you have good people who are working at MTV, MTV suddenly becomes a good place. Sometimes the Christian community in the past has been apt to do this, to say such and such is so evil, we can't be a part of it. But it's really a self-fulfilling prophecy. And so the more you participate in mainstream popular culture, then your values will begin to be felt there. So Mercy Me's song, I Can Only Imagine, really becomes a hit song because a mainstream slash secular radio station in Dallas begins to play it because listeners are requesting it. So I would credit the Mercy Me phenomenon to probably a housewife driving her van in Dallas with her kids in the back, calling the radio station and saying, can you please play I Can Only Imagine? Now, if she's not engaged with that station, she wouldn't have requested it. It wouldn't have become a hit song. There wouldn't be a movie. So it's all a kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you preach gloom and doom and the culture hates us and you don't participate, that may be true. But if you participate and get to work, and by the way, as a filmgoer, you can do that, for instance. If you attend every movie that we in Hollywood send to your local theater, you're making an important statement. If you start going to films judiciously and remembering that going to a film is like voting, then you'll begin to have an impact even as a consumer, and your $10 reverberates all the way back to Hollywood. When those numbers come in on Monday morning, they see your $10 and where it went. And so, again, I would encourage everybody to participate as much as possible. And this doesn't mean there isn't a place for Christian-oriented publications. Of course, there's always a place for magazines and radio stations and things. But I think the more that we as consumers, as Americans, can participate in the mainstream culture, the better that this culture is going to reflect your values.
Well said, and I just really appreciate you being on my podcast today. I highly recommend this book, Rock Gets Religion. So, Mark, as we close, tell my listeners how they can get your book.
Absolutely. First of all, I would welcome a visit from your listeners to my social media pages, Mark Joseph, on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. But the book itself is available at Christian and mainstream retail. Of course, it's Amazon and Christian Book and all those places. You know, it was funny because this book has kind of lived out what I was trying to do, which it opened at Amazon at number one in the new releases in the Christian section, and it opened at number 13 in the rock section. So I was pleased that it was having an impact and that fans of both Christian music and rock music were both accessing the book.
Well, that's impressive, and thank you for all that you do and for all that your family does. I've known your family for a long time. And I'll thank my listeners for listening today to the Strang Report on the Charisma Podcast Network. I'm Steve Strang. God bless you.
Thank you for listening to the Strang Report with Steve Strang. To read more from Steve, visit his blog, The Strang Report on charismamag.com. Again, it's The Strang Report on charismamag.com.
This has been a production of the Charisma Podcast Network. Steve and Joyce Strang are the founders and owners of CPN. Dr. Steve Green is the executive producer of the Charisma Podcast Network. We intend to honor God with every podcast and remain thankful to our advertisers and supporters who make these podcasts possible.